low, high, maybe GPAs from their high schools, that kind of aspect, which we can will get more detail on. Bottom line, it has obviously been a successful incentive. I firmly believe that if we ever had a program down the line that could benefit both those that are being recruited but also those that are in, it would be a significant recruiting retention benefit. We had one other number on
that,
too.
We had some other data. We asked for comparisons. I think that's what the chair was looking for. And the only comparable program that we could find was the Oregon Student Assistance Commission was the Opportunity Grants. And those are limited to 12 quarters or 8 semesters. And there is a cap of $39,090 on a household income in order to be eligible for that. Our requirement is you get in the Guard, you pass and qualify to be a Guardsman, go through your basic and advanced individual training, and then you're eligible for this program. Also, we require that if they get up to 90% of that tuition assistance, up to, not necessarily that, but up to, then you also have a requirement for 4 years additional service. And the average enlistment is 6 years, so that makes a grand total of 10 years of service. The theory being, if you get to 10, you're halfway there to a federal retirement, so there's more likely to stay in, which reduces the need to recruit more people and saves the taxpayers a lot of money. So in comparison, the only one we could find, like I said, was the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and that's limited. Basically, it's all on financial basis. We don't have that data on our students. We don't know what their economic incomes are. We don't know what their family incomes are. And we're going to try to develop more data to figure out if there is a comparable to this Oregon Opportunity Grant. The other item that was asked...
that's a key one, was the dollar figure.
If we were full strength, and I think Representative Hansen asked this question. If we were full strength in the Army Guard and the Air Guard, we would have a total average wage. The average wage with additional members would generate tax revenue of $186,027, according to our estimate. The additional student cost
tuition
cost of that same group would be $500,000. So you end up with a deficit of $400,000 is what you end up with.
What's $186,000 per year?
That would be the additional tax revenue that we estimate the state
year
would collect. That's correct.
Right. And the student cost would be $500,000?
Yes.
Is that for biennium?
Student cost would be $595,000.
For biennium or for?
Per year.
Per year. Okay.
Per year. So it's a $400,000. Now, that's assuming they all go to school.
See, the beauty of the program, quite frankly, is you can overbook. Because, like I said, initially we had 750 recruited, said, yeah, I want that tuition assistance. Of that 750, they all join. Only 468 of them to date had taken us up on it. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of an incentive program. They may have an intent, and the Army says the same thing. Why do you think they have these things where you spend 4 years in the Army and you can get $20,000 for your education? It's because 80% of those kids never either get out of the Army. If they do, they don't go back to school because they get married or they do something else, and their life moves on. So that's one beautiful aspect. You don't spend as much money as you maybe project. You're not going to spend it on everybody you recruit because with the best of intentions, they don't end up going to school, or they go 1 year instead of four.
Of course, the dynamics today with the demand for education because of the unemployment or lack of jobs
might keep them in.
May actually force them into the school.
And then that community college number, like I've said, surprised us. We did not anticipate that large of a community college participation. We thought it would be quite smaller than that, and it was 32%.
And that reduces our cost because you don't have as high a tuition on
it. It was substantially less than what we anticipated.
Anyway, that's just some ground. We can get more detailed info, but we thought we'd let you know. It's our initial blush.
$595, did that contemplate tuition at community college blend?
Yes, sir. That
okay.
That was the blended number that we thought it would be.
Right, okay.
We just can't generate enough income tax off those salaries to make it.
No, that's
understandable.
And
we knew that,
I don't think any of us anticipated that it would be dollar for dollar offset. Okay.
Okay.
Perhaps over 10 years, though.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, you never know. It's.
What's the other thing we were going to? I think that was the other one. What we were following up.
The other question was what we estimated would be at the end of the day. We said it would be without 10 or 20,000. Actually, we've redone those numbers, and it comes out that we think there'll be $53,000 remaining at the end of spring term in the tuition assistance account after we've taken all the take backs and paid this group of students, this 151 students,
make sure they finish
through spring term,
right?
And that would leave us $53,207 balance.
And how much was taken during the five special sessions?
1,117,017, if I'm right. Correct? Yeah.
To date, how much have we?
Yeah, 1,117,117.
Okay.
Yeah. So we pretty much, unfortunately, as the... See, we need to get a new economist, because every time he comes out, it's... But that was my thinking.
Well, regardless,
every time it came out, of course, and the governor was into a situation where there had to be some reductions, and unfortunately, that's what we had to do, was keep reducing that one account, and of course, we kept the youth challenge at that point open, so we weren't saving much money there.
Okay.
Thank you. Four pullouts out of that.
Yeah.
Do we have, and I'm sure it was discussed yesterday, and I probably right past me, with regard to these students following the spring, through the spring term, and no further resources within that account, do we have any legal obligation to continue to assist them?
No. There's Mr. Chair, no, probably, not a legal one.
Probably a moral obligation.
An ethical and moral one, probably, yeah. Yes. But legally, I mean, that was the whole deal. It was a biennium to biennium concept. I'm not sure as a young person I would totally understand. I don't think I understand the state budgeting system anyway. And here I am sitting here testifying. So I doubt seriously too many of our college age individuals understand.
Direct impact will be on 96 students.
Right.
That are not going to graduate spring term.
Right. That are already in the program, because we didn't enroll a number of them this year because we saw what was happening,
right?
And we figured if we enrolled them, we were in for a double impact. We were going to then have to find other cuts and, on top of it, disappoint one heck of a lot more young individuals. So we took that consciously. We took that decision.
And perhaps the demographics that Representative Patridge was seeking was the demographics of those 96 students. To find out where they may be.
We're going to do that.
Okay.
Right.
Excellent.
Okay.
Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does that 96 include not only the juniors that are going to be seniors, but also some people probably are in AA associates programs at community colleges where they've got another year to go?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, what we have right now is 54 of these are going to be seniors, 40 or 69 are going to be juniors. 27 will be sophomores. That's what's currently enrolled. So the sophomores, you can assume, are a mix. Probably about, out of that 27, I would guess there's probably 10 of them are going to be community colleges. Now, whether or not they're doing the 2 years in the community college, then go on to the university, which has been fairly commonplace for a lot of our students, I can't answer that, and we'll have to get you more information on just exactly where they fall.
Let me ask this with regard to those folks. They would still have every other opportunity, including Pell Grants and Clifford and those, what are the balance, Stafford funds, and they would have all of that available to them.
Yes, sir.
Would their military obligation interfere with any of that?
No, sir. Typically, well, Pell Grants based on need, and if you have other sources of income, then they're going to factor that in. So the Stafford grant, I think, is based on need as well, and so, but it's not as restrictive. The difference with our students, as opposed to most people that go through the OSAC, with the exception of grants in things that are designed for specific high school, specific county, specific endowment of some sort. Those typical grants need to be, they're based on academic performance. And our stipulation is to meet the entrance requirement of the institution that you're applying to. So in essence, you can come in at the lowest common denominator of that, whatever that entrance requirement is, whereas other grants, you're competing based on your academic performance in high school. And that is a big advantage to our program, because some kids don't get their act together very quickly in high school, and all of a sudden they're doing pretty well, but they don't have a GPA that makes them competitive for a presidential scholarship or some other means of help. And ours doesn't require that.
Senator Mandela?
Those Guards members who are juniors now, would they be held to any obligation of service after this, even though it's not available in their senior year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, they're required a year for year. If they receive 1 year of tuition assistance from us, they extend their enlistment 1 year. And again, the theory being that we'd have four-year students, six-year obligation, get them up to 10. If there's six-year obligation, they only get 1 year, they owe us 7. So it's 1 year for a year. If you take a year's worth of grant money from us, tuition assistance, you owe an additional year in the Guard.
Right.
Follow up.
Yes.
The $50,000+ that'll be left in the fund, obviously I wouldn't say that too loudly in this building, because
it's gone.
Yeah. It's
what 50? I misspoke.
Moral obligation. What's that?
$500.
Yeah, $500.
But would that be encumbered in any way now? I mean, in the sense of when it was placed into that fund. I mean, I'm not saying that this would happen, and I know that everybody's looking for every dollar they can get. But if you had the $54,000, would you be able to continue the program for a few of the students? Or I don't know how you'd select them. But
Chairman, Senator Devlin, what we just give you an example of how we handled the program this year on a limited basis. We sought specifically to target any additional new students being new, not previously been in the program, but had 1 year left and were officer candidates. And that was a particular need we have, because we were short officers, and so we
still are.
We'd extend some of that 151 are officer candidates. More than likely, we would look at the seniors, try to determine, you know, one, where they're at in their college, and look at them on an individual basis to use that $53,000. We're not going to move the money unless we're directed
right
by this body or knee board. We're not going to move it to something else. We wouldn't have moved the money we had in there had we not been directed to do it.
Right.
So we view it as being fenced until we're told differently.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chair, we kind of talked about a sequence here. To probably work on our performance measures first, because I think we can run through that relatively quickly. It's ours are not very complex, quite frankly, in the military department, even though we think we have a significant story to tell. And we do have the charts. Okay. We only have two performance measures. Yes.
Okay, under the tab N in your presentation notebook, page 40.
Right. And that should be the same. There should be a chart in there with this.
Page 40.
Page 40. Yeah.
Okay. We have two performance measures: force, strength, or what I call structure targets, and armory condition readiness. The data is presented to the command group quarterly, is reviewed for trends and analysis to depend if actions or efforts are effective in meeting our goals. All this data is obviously reviewed by the command group and is transmitted to the National Guard Bureau for compilation, and then is further transmitted as required to appropriate levels within the Department of Defense. Command group is able to compare Oregon's data to the national compilation of data from the other 52 states and 50 states, three territories, and the District of Columbia. In addition, the administration program also monitors several other agency-wide indicators. We monitor our economic impact to the state of Oregon. We monitor percentage of our general fund budget that is returned to Oregon through state income tax, as we've discussed. And you know the leverage piece on that. I'm not going to get into that. An important performance indicator we monitor is the number of state active duty work days we provide citizens of Oregon, but it's not a... I don't want it to be a performance measure, because technically you don't want to go on state active duty for an emergency. I mean, that's a reactionary mode. It's not something you want to say, oh boy, we got to increase our state active duty because half the state burned down. So it's not really a performance measure that you would benchmark to, because you'd actually like to see zero, if at all possible. So the forest fires, and you know, we've talked about that, and helicopter support, and our members did over 24,000 day work days of support during the last emergency. The other, and as you can see on this one, if you look at the agency goal, assure a ready trained force for rapid response to emergencies. There is a force structure index that is measured through all of our federal and state levels at our military department. We have a long-range goal. I have a strategic planning group for both the Air and the Army that establishes our long-range goals for our strength attainment. You can't get there overnight, and, of course, tuition assistance helped us get to a portion of our goal already. And right now, the target's 2005 to get that index to 100%. Could be questionable in today's turbulent environment. This was established before the significant call-ups and before some of the other factors we're going to have to deal with budget-wise. This may have to be pushed out to 2006, 2007 on the realization of our strength goals and objectives. And enhance our community support and readiness for emergency response. Again, percent of the statewide armories, that's our other performance measure. And that goes back to the charts we briefed yesterday regarding the readiness condition. We measure it along with all national entities through Department of Defense, the readiness levels of our armories, of our facilities, and what it would take to bring them to, quote, at least a passable or standard mark. We have that as a performance measure and an objective, but it is totally based upon the funding that we can get either through the federal or state government in order to bring those armories to standard or to replace the armories through the future year defense plan and gain monies to build a new one. So, again, it's a performance measure. It does link to one of our primary goals to support the citizens of Oregon in times of need. But I can put a measurement objective, 65%, but can I reach it with the backlog of deferred maintenance? And we all know there's a lack of monies to address that, and with the federal government also restricting the monies right now that they're going to be available with the deficit spending that's going on and, quote, the war that's probably going to be prosecuted. So those are our two performance measures. I'm not sure there's a lot of detail in that we need to go over. There's methods. What I will tell you is we don't make up the measurement criteria here. The measurement criteria is established nationally, in one case by Department of Defense, in the other case by National Guard Bureau. We can benchmark against other states. As a matter of fact, last year we ended up 7th out of the 54 states and territories in District of Columbia on our strength indicators. It's the highest we've ever been, and if you take out the states that had full tuition assistance, we were 4th. So actually we had a significant year last year. It's very proud of it. Well, we're not sure of the call-up. You know, the current impacts of bringing people, taking them out of school, away from their jobs, away from their families. If you start with September 11th and you go through the various, the 82nd Rear Operations Center has been mobilized twice in the last 3 years. The 1042nd Air Ambulance Company has been mobilized twice in the last 18 months. The significant impacts on September 11th on a number of our soldiers that have been on dual or triple duty, add into that our state active duty over the summer, I'm not sure what the impact is going to have on strength. I personally think it will have a negative impact. I think less people will be inclined to extend their enlistments, not because they don't like the Guard, not because they're not patriotic, but because they have done their chore. They've saluted. They've done it honorably. And they want their lives to be a little more predictable. So I predict throughout the country, not just Oregon, there'll be a little more turbulence and a little less retention for those people coming up on their terms of enlistment from 1 to 2 years out for the next 3 or 4 years. So I think I'm going to struggle maybe to make some of the strength management goals. That's why I'm pushing that. I think I'm going to have to push that target out in my strategic planning group out to maybe 2007 to reach our 100% indicator. But it is definitely a goal.
And
they don't directly, not to interrupt, but they don't. The real key is these aren't direct, what do you call them, direct impact with the Oregon benchmarks. We're not a primary benchmark item. Military department, I've struggled with this. In fact, we were talking at lunch. I've struggled with this since the beginning of the benchmark process because I was working for General Reese at the time and working with Governor Roberts' administration. And I've struggled with the impact that the National Guard definitely has, positive impact, and the constitutional basis of it, and how you measure that in many of the major criteria we're looking at the state. It is a struggle. It's not that we're unimportant. It's just we don't seem to be a mainline agency in that respect for most of our what you can measure. So, but these are the two.
As I look at the performance measures in relationship to the mission, it talks in the mission statement as to training and equipment. Now, I recognize that equipment goes a long ways towards the armory issue because they're fully equipped there. What of the training? Do we assume that all of the training, all of these folks, I mean, if they're showing up for duty, they are trained?
Mr. Chair, yeah, there's a specific established criteria by the Air Force and the Army regarding the levels of training that we must attain and the levels of maintenance and repair that we must keep all of our equipment, weapon systems through vehicles, through generators, you name it. And technically we could probably make that an objective because we measure those. Those, again, are federal standards that have to be maintained. And I tell you, we do exceptionally well in both the Air and the Army, as is told by many of our deployments, quite frankly. Those are indicators of the readiness of our force, because my task is to ensure that the Air and the Army Guard members are ready to be mobilized and deployed for a federal contingency as well as a state. So we measure this. We measure so many things. You wouldn't believe how many measurement criteria we end up dealing with between Department of Defense, Department of Army, Department of Air Force, National Guard Bureau, and, of course, our own state agencies, and then the various auditing processes we go through. It's a significant number of measurement tools we have.
Maybe to give you a good example of that would be all of our vehicles have a requirement to have an oil analysis every so many miles, every so many months. And we have over, 3,000 vehicles, I think, or 3,000 pieces of equipment in Oregon that require that analysis.
And you're 100% on that?
We get it all done. We're 100% of getting it all accomplished.
We meet the criteria.
We meet the criteria that meets the National Guard Bureau standard. And that, of course, indicates maintenance problems down the road. And it comes back to us in a printout, and then we have to go maybe find that vehicle in Ontario and evacuate it to Clackamas to have the engine rebuilt on it or something. And so we do that on a constant basis, on a daily flow. It's not measured under benchmarks. We do the same thing with personnel. We have a certain amount of criteria that we got to go through, and we got to check personnel records and physicals, and we call it SRPs, Soldier Readiness
Program.
Where we go through and make sure that they've been to the dentist and they had a dental check, and we have to do that every so often as well. So I mean, we treat people in vehicles similarly. We do a blood test on them instead of an oil check, but
right.
You know, it's the same kind of an operation. And we have certain requirements that we have to meet every year a certain percentage of them. A certain percentage of our people have to have a drug test every year at random, and we do that every month. So there's a constant battery of checks and balances that we're required to do every single month in our system with these 9,000 personnel.
With regard to the personnel, and again, I assume training, as you say, General, could be a measurement to make sure that we do have training, and the equipped issue, you've addressed that, Colonel Caldwell. But I guess one thing, just a question, relative to personnel, do we have any personnel that do not show up on a regular basis? Is that a problem? And I assume the military has its own set of standards for those kinds of things. But I guess the concern I've got is that recently, I think we heard in Utah that someone went conscientious just as they were loading up.
It happened. Yes,
and that's a concern. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't really speak necessarily to training. It doesn't speak necessarily to the lack of the mission, but
right.
And I don't know that I'd even want to discuss that publicly.
No, Mr. Chair, it's a good question. I mean, there are measurement tools for that. It's called a non-valid pay status. In other words, somebody that has not been paid over a 60-day period for whatever reason. Now, sometimes it's valid. They're on leave, or you've made some arrangement, or they're on active duty, and they get counted as a non-drilling member. So, yes, we track what we call AWOLs. We track that non-valid pay, and we are in the top percentile in the country on non-valid pay. Our numbers, in other words, are clean. And, yes, there's a measurement technique for that.
1.4%.
Yeah, it's 1.4% for the state right now. Which is an acceptable number, because there's valid reasons for people being on that. Sometimes they move and take off, and we have to search them and find them another state and make sure that they get back into a drilling status.
14 out of 1,000.
Right. And we did have one person split on this 1162. 402 people were supposed to ship out, and one kid got nervous the night before, but his brothers are looking for him. I think they tracked him already, but the unit, we have measures to go find those individuals and reacquaint them with the Constitution of the United States and their duty to support and defend it.
I love the military. They talk about, when they talk about moving a piece of equipment from one place, that's an evacuation. I mean, reacquainting with the Constitution. Send your dub on.
Well, General, actually that percentage that you... If you were talking active military, I don't think it would be much lower than that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, it's higher. When we come to deployability, and this was proven in Desert Storm call-ups also, a lot of horror stories about Guard members and reservists, mostly medical and dental issues, because we don't have a medical and dental plan, and they're not on base, and we can't take these young people and pay for, and our dentists that work for us can't even legally do dental work on the weekend. They can do a check, but they can't do dental work by law. So we do have some distractors and some hurdles, but in essence, our deployability rates on the Guard and Reserve are higher than most active duty units. They have problems, too. They have individuals that get sick. They have people that go AWOL. They have people that break laws. They have some people that take drugs. They have a cross-section of society as well as the Guard. And that's just something you have to work with in the lab. But yeah, the Guard does very well. And the Oregon Guard, quite frankly, has had a reputation for a number of years of being very professional and representing the state very well. Not saying we don't make mistakes. We do, but pretty small, minimal.
Mr. Chairman, not to belabor this too much, but I would expect, as you said, that your percentage is actually probably even lower than what it would be for active. And obviously quite a bit of time in active, you're dealing with relatively young individuals.
Yes. Yes, that's true.
That other interests come up and may sway them in different ways, whether or not what their duty is today or tomorrow. Or when you're dealing with a bunch of 19- and 20-year-olds, it's a lot different.
There's no doubt. The active component has some advantages because you have them on an everyday basis. And you can do sometimes a better job of looking after needs, but you're right. Young people are young people, whether they're here in the Guard or in the active component. They are That's why you have a chain of command, and that's why you have a training regimen that you have to follow.
I'd ask this question relative to the comment that you made relative to the professionals, dentists and doctors, applying their trades.
Right.
That's not legal for them to apply their trade in the military?
Mr. Chair, on a drilling status, what we call Title 32 status by U.S. Code, a drilling status, a dentist can do what we call a soldier readiness plan. In other words, he or she can go in and ensure that the person has teeth and what they need to have fixed. But they cannot fix it on a drilling time. They would have to do it on an appointment, pay basis, other than an emergency. Now, once they're mobilized, they go active duty, then they can do it, or we can bring in dentists or doctors from the active component, which we do all the time, to bring our soldiers up to a deployable standard. Teeth are actually one of the biggest deployment inhibitors, because they don't want to send a young person to, let's say, Afghanistan, which doesn't have or Kuwait, even if they're in a conflict, and it doesn't have a robust dental system. They don't want to send them there with a significant problem. Now, if they're sending them to Germany to backfill, they'll say, okay, he can go with this because they'll fix it over there. So the Army, the Department of Defense does watch this kind of thing for the right reasons. And Guard members will have a higher issue with more of an issue with dental because, again, they're not full-time, they're not on a post, and we can't fix their teeth, and there's no health insurance or dental insurance for them adequate to do it. So it is, but it isn't a big inhibitor, quite frankly. We haven't had to turn down many young people here recently. Matter of fact, I think our SRPs have gone. Yes, 10 years ago was much more significant than it is today.
Might add, sir, to your question earlier, you talked about the camps and the training, and that's where the state-federal partnership comes in. Our agreement with the federal government is to provide camps. We have, as we showed on the map, we have several camps, and our job is to provide those camps so these soldiers can train in those camps.
Right.
Now, 99% of the funding in most cases is federal funding. But for instance, Camp Rylea gets zero state dollars other than other funds that they generate by renting to the state police, or we bring in active component and we charge active component fees to use our facilities. That's a state-owned camp. It's owned by the state of Oregon. It's operated by the state of Oregon. But without that camp, we can't maintain our level of training. And the same with the other locations that we have. But we last general fund dollar went into that in 93, I think.
You're right.
And we used to have a small amount of general fund that went in there to take care of things, but we got cut, so we haven't done that. And we've been able to survive. We've been able to do just, okay with it by expanding our client base and literally taking anybody that could have money to come in the door, and we'd rent our facilities to them. And we generate other funds from that, and then we hire people to do the work that we need done for our soldiers on the weekend.
Right.
So that's how we've been able to modify our operations to survive. The other comment about people getting out, 87% of our losses last year were from people, those were people that didn't re-enlist. 87% of them were six-year full-term, had done their duty, and elected not to re-enlist. We only had 1% that went out because of law violation, a drug violation, or something that was negative. The others were either retirees, medical discharges, or they moved out of the state.
Again, as Senator Devlin indicates, you got a more mature audience that you're playing to at that particular point, and life is, most of the frivolities of the late teenage years have long since passed them at that point.
And typically, by the time they're 6 years, they're 24, 25 years old, they've got a job that they don't want to risk losing because they visualize that they're going to be in there for a while, their family's started, they have a house payment and a few other things, and so we've gone and analyzed this, recognizing if we can turn some of that 87% loss around to reenlistment, then we solve our strength problem. But it's very difficult at that age group because of their lifestyle changes. When they were 18, they had a car and they lived with mom and dad. And they were maybe going to school, maybe not, maybe working part-time, didn't really. Now, 24, 25, we're starting to see them settle down, and they don't want to get jerked out of their lifestyle that they've just created and go off to Kuwait or Afghanistan. So
And Mike says then they get in their second childhood and run for the legislature. Is that true? They get frivolous again.
That's what happens to Harper.
Senator Devlin's case, he's much younger than myself. I'm up at the far end of that. Couldn't hold up.
I can still remember the 1920s.
I can't even remember
it's a distant memory.
Yeah, it gets worse. Well, Mr. Chair, I can move on to our prioritized list and continue to move questions, but really our prioritized list of services for our military department, we've only got the four areas. We've got administration, operations, community support, and capital construction. Obviously not as complex in some methods as many agencies, but in some cases more complex because of the various state and federal mixes of funds that we have to deal with and be audited on, both from a state and federal perspective, fairly significant audits. With all the cooperative agreements, all of the various... I'm not sure where...
I asked them if they had a chart on that.
Look in the plan.
Did they get one? Why don't you just slide up there with a couple?
I have one.
As I testified yesterday and moved through the budgetary process, these were the four program areas that we deal with. Obviously, administration and operations are, quite frankly, where our general fund is spent. And it's, if you really look at it, it's personnel. There isn't a lot of wiggle room left. It's personnel. And in operations is the significant piece of personnel. And that's where we get back down to the maintenance, the armory technicians. And there's a world of debate about if we cut 23 positions, how much do you save over biennium versus what are you going to have to contract for? What kind of rental revenue do you lose without having that everyday person there? And they're not at every armory as it is. I mean, they still have to travel. I think it's very debatable how much you save in the long run. In fact, it could be like that deferred maintenance chart. You could save for a year or two and then have a significant expense because things aren't being checked on a regular basis. I think we all know what a maintenance program of any kind, whether it's your car, you could drive your car for 100,000 miles. And maybe throw some extra oil in every once in a while, but maybe you wouldn't, and then maybe you've got to pay $50,000 to repair versus repairing as you go. So these are our program areas. Community support, we're really down to, I think, just one general funded employee anymore, and that's in
public affairs.
And we used to have four.
So
it doesn't on this chart, and that's interesting. I don't know how we may have moved it into administration. And it may be in administration now. Yeah. Because really, public affairs fits administration. They work with community support, but they work under admin because they're in my office. But again, where do we go as far as if we were talking a cut list? We're still reviewing the options of reducing some AOTs. We've looked at some of the discussions regarding reducing work weeks. I'm not sure in the long run that's the best option. Not because you wouldn't get the work done, because I think you lay in some future issues. And, of course, the other option is closing armories and trying to save monies, operational monies, maintenance monies. Look at our oldest armories first. The real issue you have with that, again, is you won't maintain the force structure. Now you're going to start losing units. They'll go back to the federal government to replace in another state, so you start, it's kind of a vicious circle as you go down. You could say, well, they could go up and guys in Cottage Grove could go to Eugene, people in Lebanon could go somewhere. That only works so far, and some of those people generally we find get out because their local armory is gone. The ties are gone, and they don't want to drive that far, whatever reason. You end up seeking your level. You never gain percentage strength by reducing your requirement. What you do is it finds its level, and if you're at 95%, you're going to be at 95% again. It's a law of nature. It's like low-hanging fruit. I mean, if you set your expectations low, you'll reach your expectations. If you set them high, you may not reach them, but you'll be better off, and people will meet those expectations. Same thing in armories. If we close them, there are some utility savings, yes, and we're going to look at that. But the real danger is community support, the recruiting retention base that we have. Ultimately, I think it not only loses financially, but it loses in our capability to reach out to every community in the state and support them in time of need. So that's what I'm looking at as far as our priority list. And if we continue to cut, we don't have much left to cut in administration. We're down to we've been cutting through administration. Operations, the only area is individuals and or impact of closing armories or a combination, and we're going to play around with a number of scenarios in that area, and that's a worst case situation, significantly worst case, and it would not be a good signal for us or for the Guard, obviously, but if we end up having to do it, that's the directions we're going to have to go.
We might add one thing. We've built this budget on the expectation that we're going to increase our armory rentals by 22%, and that's a very aggressive number. The reason we think we can do that is that we have a plan at Department of Administrative Services right now that we think will be approved that actually has a benefit to the armory operating technician, the AOT, after they reach a certain level of rental income per quarter. If they increase that, then they will share in that.
Right.
That profit. We're looking at more of the Les Schwab model, if you will, to try to get them to be participants in it so it's no longer a negative, just adding more work. They actually, by renting it, aggressively renting it and getting out people to use the facility, they actually benefit from that. That's sitting on DAS's table. If they approve it, then we think we can go 22%. If they don't approve it, then we're not going to meet that expectation.
It's an option. It's a creative, innovative option, which is really what, as we talked with Mr. Weeks yesterday, we are, as a state, looking for innovative ways to do our job legally, professionally and legally, and all agencies, I think, will be looking at something along those lines. I'm just kind of stuck in the position that I don't have a lot of, as you know, with 45 positions left, that are generally funded, there just isn't a lot of wiggle room. So we're going to have to come up with some different ideas.
So failing a 22% increase in rentals, where do those efficiencies begin to be taken? Maintenance.
Yep. Yep. And AOT positions, maintenance, and again, I do have an armory list, but we did that back in 91-93 biennium. And quite frankly, it didn't put us in that good a position.
A good example, in 91-93, we closed Silverton Armory. That unit had been a 140-member armory unit for as many years as you could count. Probably was there since the turn of the century. We shut that down under the belief that
they
would come to Salem, and we could keep that unit whole and keep it in Salem. Today, and I had the zip codes run today from that surrounding Silverton area. We've got 22 people that still live in the Silverton area and serve in the American Guard. We had 140, so there's 120, 118 people there theoretically. A recruiting base, 4A high school, just like Ontario, well, bigger than Ontario, and, you know, 4A high school, we should be able to recruit 100 people out of there.
With the same number serving in total in the Guard back then as there are today?
Numbers were about the same. Our force structure was higher, but we weren't strength-wise, we were a little higher. But then again, we had more armories in the state at the time, too.
But at that time, if you had 2,000 total personnel, and today you had 1,000 personnel, and you were down from 140 down to 20, then maybe that would indicate that really the number was about 70 of those at that time, which still translates into an 80% loss, I mean, under the best of circumstances.
It was a significant loss. We had hoped that we could, you know, still recruit in the area, still get people interested, you know, people that live there. Our best recruiters are our own people when they're talking to their neighbors and they're talking to their coworkers and other things like that. Without that recruiting, without that armory being in that town, that base is there, but we're not impacting it. So we have a significant loss from that, from losing that facility.
I still like the idea of education being a good recruiter. I think that's a triple win for everybody. I mean, you get more income taxes, you get better trained staff for your own needs and personnel, and then Oregon wins because we've got an educated society and education is like that teaching a person to fish. The next generation is prone to get even better education still. So.
We give you anecdotal stories, but I can tell you there's lots of them out there that these kids would not be getting college educations had it not been for the National Guard. And there in itself, it gives them a leg up and a bootstrap to get out of where they're at and get an education based on their service. And we get a double whammy. We just don't give them the money, we get service in return for that.
You bet.
So we are looking at it. That's our project areas. And really, I don't think we have much else to testify about, and any technical questions we can come back with better numbers. I mean, we're researching many options right now. If there's a worst case scenario that appears on the horizon, and dealing with the legislature and with the governor's office and with DAS regarding where we can go from here and still maintain this viable organization. Mandated by obviously the Constitution, but still a very viable organization. Because what really happens, the same thing as Youth Challenge. Once you close something down, the synergy and energy and resourcing in order to rebuild it back up, it just isn't going to happen in the National Guard. It just is not going to happen. You'll seek another level. And you'll be good at that level, but you're not gonna go back and reopen Cottage Grove, Lebanon, Burns, Dalles, Milton, Fairwater. You're not gonna go back and reopen. It's not gonna happen. So that's why I really don't want to go. Unless absolutely forced to, I don't want to go that direction because we're going to lose some force structure in the state of Oregon. They'll say you're not supporting it to the standard, therefore this structure has to move. And then of course we lose a facility in a community. And you're talking about the backbone of our state, not just the Willamette Valley, but you're talking about small town USA. We can't destroy that.
But in those communities where that force is stronger and stronger, and you have a good really good morale and
community support,
then you're making the additional commitment and dedication to the community, and it seems to just snowball. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. General and Colonel, I was trying to search through here for something that we've seen in other budgets, and I'm not finding it, actually, and maybe it just doesn't exist.
Quite possible.
But given the nature of your operations, would there be DAS charges in here in terms of the liability issues?
Oh. Yes, sir.
Well, they do exist.
Yeah. They're in.
Because we've seen some sizable changes for other departments. And,
you got that mic?
It's an 030 packages, and your...
So budget page 61. Okay. Current services legal for my one. 61. That says major construction.
Well,
all
right, budget page 61 is the agency summary. You'll find the first one under administration. On page 122, 121 and 122. 293, 725.
That's state government service charges.
030.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we don't have the breakdown of the individual charges we have today, so we'll have to
get
you. You're likely to see increased risk charges overall. As you know, the workers' comp assessment is being charged agents in the first 10 years. the other issues have gone up for a number of reasons as well.
It would be interesting, to, Mr. Chairman, to just get that number. I'm not saying that we can do anything about it, quite honestly, because the situation, at least for a portion of that, is that we've gone down our reserves to nothing, practically.
Chair and Senator Devlin, that issue is likely to be dealt with on a statewide basis, and everybody's budgets will reflect whatever changes are come about as a result of the work that they do in general government with the Department of Administration.
Senator Devlin sits on that general government.
When you do that, you'll have an effect on this budget.
The chair of that committee and I might be in agreement on some of that.
Well, I'm wondering if we can't find an opportunity in that process to somehow exempt the guard from some of the frivolous lawsuits, but that's probably a constitutional issue. So.
We don't allow
frivolous lawsuits. Yeah, we just like the good ones.
Just ignore those.
We only allow the good ones.
Chairman,
Senator.
I'm sure you've heard this. We have our constitutional issues here. When you say a bill has a constitutional issue, it's usually a pretty clear indication, isn't it? It's not necessarily that it violates the U.S. or the or the federal or the state constitution. It lacks the votes.
That's about as constitutional as you can get it. Yeah,
that's a major constitutional issue.
Yes, it is.
Let's see. In that regard, we have. There are other issues. The priorities list is different than what we have seen in other agencies, how they've presented this, Susie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that, I don't know how our co-chairs are going to be, whether they're going to be anxious that these be uniform when we come back to, to present our lists. But bless you. There's certainly an issue as to how that's going to play into the hands of how we eventually end up in the other room in our overall budget cuts and structure. So we'll probably need for Susie to work with you, Bill, to get some of that put together, so that the list of priorities in relationship to the goals and mission. And then the 10% cuts list and the 30% reductions list are in the same order and fashion. And there's an added benefit to that and bringing that into the record. And that is that it helps the Ways and Means process in the future to define what it is that the Guard was all about, what their priorities were in relationship to some cuts down there. And it's assumed that, you know, that the cuts are way down the list and in other areas, but we need to know what it is that we're going to be giving up in any kind of a cuts package, and that's why I ask about the loss of the enhanced armory rentals, which in effect is a cut to your budget.
Yes, it is.
And that concerns me because I think that plays right in the hands of the loss of a trained and ready force in the state. So we need to be very cautious about that. I mean, virtually what happens... The first dollar is cut by the loss of rental income, and that's not a ways and means process. That's a failure to meet the expectations process. Cuts into the core mission of the agency,
right?
And that's a very serious situation. That means that the first cuts down at this end affect the very top priorities at the other end. That's something we've been trying to avoid and trying to stay away from. But I don't know how you go. I really don't. Without a priorities list and without the 10% cuts list, I don't know how you go there. So, but that's something we probably ought to have.
I think Doug mentioned to me that he was going to have agencies meet with him on Monday to go over what he was looking for in the priority listing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and there is some confusion. We talked about it yesterday in the meeting even. There's been some confusion, obviously, as in consternation as we go through two processes, trying to finish out this biennium as well as prepare for an 0305. And, yeah, none of us, I don't think, are on the same sheet of music, nor at the detail that you're talking, but it has to be done in the same methodology for everybody. So I'm sure Bill will work with us.
Okay, can we just pause for just a moment?
Sure.
Let's see if we've eaten up another tape.
we can pause all day if you
want. I'm not saying anything.
You hear an elected official say that? No?
Well, record this.
We have to go back and start.
Oh, God.
We gaveled out.
I can never do this
again. Can we do that? Can we adjourn?
Adjourn. We can adjourn if you want.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
H-E-J-O-U-R. Yeah, I can make it. I can make my own. Walk far. Oh, you heard me that time, huh?
Yeah. Good. Get that for the record.
I think
Chair Patrick. Huh?
Okay. A-D-J-O-U-R-N.
Okay, go ahead.
We'll just get it on the tape. I'll just hold it up and wherever the cameras. Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Colonel.
Yep.
And we were just a subcommittee with subcommittee anyway. Well, yesterday I passed a message to represent Patrick. Maybe we got to tack on an extra 5 cents.
Telephone.
Each line. Thank you, tack on an extra 5 cents for telephone fees in the state of Oregon.
We have the best.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think we could fund it if you had a what would you call it? Representative Patrick looked at me and said, "You've become liberal." I said, "No, it would be some sort of a military Oregon military communications fee, 5 cents per telephone line." dedicated straight
that
to
was
the military.
Spanish American War.
You talked about.
That's how the telephone tax, the federal telephone tax,
versus this day is put on 1.4 cents.
And it's still on today.
And all I'm saying is, you just put that 5 cents on per line. That's a huge amount of money. That's a huge amount of money. But it's got to be dedicated exclusively to the Oregon military, so they can come back in with their scholarships.
Four nine.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the things is they told me in the LF or in legislative council that if you dedicate it so that it cannot be removed legislatively, the way that you do that is that you have a 3/4 vote, 75% vote of both chambers, and then it requires a 3/5 vote to undo it, to take it away from, so that you'd say.